What is the agency doing as part of the Pearl Harbor Remembrance this year?
For us, Pearl Harbor is something that we're deeply connected to. One of the biggest projects that we have still ongoing is the disinterment of the unknowns from the USS Oklahoma, which sank on December 7th. We have also disinterred the remains of unknowns from the USS California, as well as the USS West Virginia, also two battleships that sunk on December 7th.
And how many men are missing from those ships, and how many are you working on?
So 388 from the USS Oklahoma. From the USS West Virginia, it's 35. And from the USS California, it's 25. So approximately close to 450 unknowns from those three battleships.
And every year you make a little bit more progress. You identify more people. And pretty soon there won't be any more Pearl Harbor survivors coming back to mark the event. What's the emotional significance of specifically identifying these MIAs for this event?
For us, it's a commitment to the service members themselves who made the ultimate sacrifice in defense of this nation, its liberties, and its freedoms. But there's also a commitment to the families of the missing. Those are the ones we primarily serve. And then the third category, actually two other categories, is the fact that for the veterans whose comrades in arms are missing, there's that sense of connection, that sense of recovery. Those survivors that you talked about, obviously we would not have them. But it sends a strong signal to the veterans of all wars that this nation will spare no expense. And the last category that I think this work speaks to are those currently serving in uniform, that this nation will spare no expense to ensure that they, if should they go missing, will be brought home to their families.
And why do you think the United States and the U.S. government have made such a point to create this mission and to fund it when other nations don't necessarily share that commitment?
Number one, I think it defines us as a nation, that the values that we've placed on service to country, on the fact of individuals going off to combat and making the supreme sacrifice, is something that we have that sacred obligation, almost a moral imperative too. That I think this, again, speaks to our values, that you know, this is something that, again, defines us as to who we are as a nation, that we commit the resources, the energy, and the focus toward this effort.
We don't really have any missing, any MIA service members from 20 years of war in Iraq or Afghanistan, which is a good thing. But do you think that you folks are going to work yourselves out of a job someday?
We won't, because unfortunately the numbers are staggering. From the conflicts that we work, we're bounded by World War II through the Operation Iraqi Freedom. There are 82,000 that are still unaccounted for. Now, majority of them are deep water at sea losses, and so we estimate that the recoverable number is 34,000. But as you can see, doing the math, it is still a steep, staunch challenge ahead of us.
And I just walked through your lab, one of your two labs, and it's extremely high tech. It's brand new. That costs a lot of money. As the director of this agency, do you have to argue and defend the mission and to get the budget to do this mission?
We do. Like all activities within the Department of Defense, we compete for resources that oftentimes are stretched, or in this case, in the last year or two, it's been dedicated to combat readiness, to lethality, of which neither of which are DPAA strengths. And so for us, we have to make the argument. And we've been very successful because the Department of Defense is committed to this mission. It's committed to the fact that, again, we owe it to the service members that are missing as well as their families, that we need to come up with these answers for them that they've been seeking for many years. We've also enjoyed great success with the Congress, who understand this is a bipartisan issue. They understand that this is something that, again, defines the United States. And so for us, we've been able to secure support from the Congress for our budget request in each of the last fiscal years.
I attended the ceremony earlier this summer when one of the gentlemen who was returned from North Korea had been identified and his family was there. And it was an extremely emotional event. His son spoke, and he said that his father left for war when he was 3 years old, I believe, and he had, you know, never expected to see him again. Can you just share an experience maybe you've had with a family member or family members from someone that you've brought home?
I actually encountered Charles McDaniel and his brother Larry in Washington when we gave them the dog tag of their father. It was the only personal effect that was in the 55 boxes. At the time, we didn't know that we would be linking those remains from those 55 boxes to Master Sergeant McDaniel, but because we possessed both his jawbone as well as his collarbone, we were able to make an immediate identification. I remember one of the most poignant things that Charles told me. He was a retired Army chaplain. He told me that it was very surreal for him because for many years of being a chaplain, he was the one providing families solace. He was the one giving them comfort, ensuring that their loss, their grieving, was something that he was empathetic to. He said it was very surreal for him now to have it reversed, that the Army was coming to him and saying, "We're sorry for your loss. What can we do to provide you some solace?" And that speaks again to why this is such an important mission for the United States, because decades of time, even generations that may have passed, have not changed the loss that these families are feeling. It is a void in their life, but what makes it different than most Gold Star families being families whose loved ones have been lost in combat, is the fact that there's an uncertainty attached to it, that for decades they didn't know. And so that just, in our view, exacerbates the loss, the grieving. And so for these families to be able to achieve those answers, it does provide some solace to them.
And there are, we've talked primarily today about the scientific challenges surrounding making an identification, but I imagine there are a lot of other challenges related to logistics and geopolitics and foreign relations. Could you talk a little bit about that? What goes into actually getting people on the ground to go and find these remains in foreign countries?
It first begins with access. We are highly dependent upon our host nation partners. Currently, we work with 46 different nations across the globe, wherever a service member was lost. And many of them, to their credit, view this as a humanitarian mission. Even with a Russia or a China, where there may be challenges or tension in the overarching relationship, we're allowed to still communicate and do actively with Russia and China. Last week, we hosted a Russian delegation in Washington, D.C., to talk about access to archives and to talk about losses from World War II through Vietnam. And so for us, it begins with negotiating with a host nation. As I said again, most of them view it as a humanitarian mission and one that, again, they're willing to cooperate on. Then it takes us into the fact that our historians, our researchers, our analysts need to develop the body of knowledge to narrow an area down whereby we might send a field investigation team to narrow it down even further. And assuming they are successful, then we would send a recovery team, an excavation team, which, as you know, can imagine, develops a whole logistical tale that entails both the fact that they're out in the field for anywhere from 30 to 60 days, oftentimes in a remote, austere location, and they're having to sustain themselves, both logistically as well as care and feeding of the team, as they go about the laborious, painstaking work of excavation.
And, Director, this agency has had some problems in the past that were publicized. What's being done, or what have you done under your watch since you've taken over to make sure things like that don't happen again?
I think it speaks to the fact that this mission was trifurcated from the standpoint that two major agencies were tasked with doing this. And I think there was no commonality, there was no common vision, there was no common strategy, there was infighting. And so I think for the most part, the merger of the three agencies in 2015, I think, led to the fact that we needed to start breaking down walls and silos that had been created. Because, again, the numbers are daunting, the challenges are steep. It's incumbent upon all of us to be able to develop this and expand the mission, create an environment that facilitates the tough work that we have ahead of us. I think one of the things we're most proud of is the fact that with the authority Congress gave us to establish public-private partnerships, we're able to then engage in work with universities, non-governmental organizations, private researchers, and we've done that. I think right now we have up to 65 arrangements that we've worked on and that we have in place. We have a university in Vietnam with three anthropologists there. We have the university in the Philippines. A university found the first Tuskegee Airmen, MIA. There's 27 of them. They found both a collaboration between the University of New Orleans and the University of Innsbruck. They were able to find Captain Dixon, who was the first Tuskegee Airman to be recovered. I think that speaks, again, to what the art of the possible is and why this new authority. We will never be able to do it organically on our own. We need the help of subject matter experts in anthropology, in archaeology, in history that we are reaching out to, and we're engaging in some very active and productive, successful collaborations.
And your agency is also leading the world in developing a lot of these techniques, too, right?
We are. So, for instance, one of the things that we patented, first of all, our laboratories, one in Omaha, Nebraska, and one here at Honolulu, are world-renowned. They are the foremost, paramount, eminent researchers when it comes to human skeletal anthropology. They've developed incredible techniques over the years. One that we're really excited about is this radiographic matching comparison. I never knew this, but your clavicle, your collarbone, is as unique as a fingerprint. If we're able to recover a serviceman's collarbone from the field and match it to an X-ray we have on file from when they enter the military, that is a one line of evidence that we utilize to, again, make that identification.
And one line of many working towards getting those 80,000 missing service members
Absolutely.
Identified. All right. Director McCaig, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you again, Ryan.